I think that's close enough. 8:40. As I said a few days ago, the important people are here. Those with a good karma. So, for this morning's Dharma talk, it's coming to the end of these series of talks, but there'll always be more coming afterwards. Things never really stop unless you get to Parinirvana. They just go round and round again. So, for today's talk, somebody mentioned last night in the question time about somebody who was thought they were enlightened, and I mentioned about aspiring towards Nirvana. Do you know really where you're aspiring towards? It's like going in your bus tomorrow and the driver doesn't know where the heck he's going. You know, where is Colombo? And actually that happened to me once. One time when I was came to Sri Lanka to give some talks, and one of those talks was in Kandy, Peridinia, the university up there. And after the talk was finished, my driver drove me back from Kandy to Colombo, and he decided he was a well-known Sri Lankan family. I won't tell you exactly what family it was, but it starts with Wetty and ends with Mooney. And he decided to take a shortcut to avoid the traffic. And he got totally lost. And we ended up just a little bit north of Kalutara, which, if you know Sri Lanka, is really lost. And then he sort of, he drove me back, eventually about 3 or 4 hours late. Everyone else had arrived by then. And, you know, so sometimes if you don't know which way to go, it's so easy to get lost on the path to liberation, on the path to enlightenment. And I did give a very practical piece of advice with the simile of the mist and how to just to go down, down, down until the mist clears. But in particular today, I think it's a good idea to talk about enlightenment, Nirvana, and the stages, and what happens, and how you can recognize these things, and what do you do if it happens to you. And it's the first story, because now everybody wants to get enlightened, which means that it becomes this great aspiration which they want. And because they haven't got much of a clue of what it really means, they ask, you know, important people, scholars, great monks or nuns, you know, to actually to confirm their attainments. And because of the craving to be enlightened these days, which is totally counterproductive, somebody, a Sri Lankan man, told me one of my favorite stories. I just checked whether I told this before on this retreat. He said I hadn't. The one about the old grandma from upcountry Sri Lanka somewhere who was visiting her relations in Colombo. And you know, she was a very devout Buddhist, would always go to the temple on Poya Day, keep precepts, offer dana to the monks. And because she was visiting in Colombo, you know, her grandchildren thought, what can we give as a gift to our grandma? And they thought, well, there was a retreat being held somewhere outside Colombo. Maybe, some of you maybe know this one. I don't. I just heard the general details in the story. There's a retreat. It was organized by lay people. And it was for something like a month or quite a long time, where there was not just meditation instructions, but also teaching the Dhamma. And at the end of the retreat, they would give a little test, you know, an interview to see how deep you understood the Dhamma and how deep your meditations were. And as a result of that test, like an examination at school, they would hand out certificates. Congratulations, you've made stream meaning, or once returning, or non-returning, or even how they gave out certificates so you could actually put it on your wall at home. A guaranteed, certified arahat. It's so crazy that people will believe in that stuff to begin with. But anyway, this is what happened. They decided to sponsor their grandma for this retreat. It's a wonderful gift of Dhamma for their dear grandma who lived way up in the country somewhere. So she accepted and she went there. She was a good meditator, pretty good understanding of the Dhamma. And at the end of the retreat, they gave her the tests. And then after the results of the tests were found, they came up to her with great joy and said, "Grandma, congratulations. You have attained to Soan, stream winning. And here is your certificate." And the grandma was so angry and upset. So disappointed. So irritated. And they said, "Grandma, why are you so angry? You're Soan, stream winner, certified by the experts. It means you will only have 6 more births. Suffering has almost ended for you. You should be so delighted that you're a stream winner. Why are you so upset and angry?" And she looked at them and said, "You don't remember me, do you?" "No. I came here 2 years ago, and you gave me anagami. Now I've been demoted." So, I mean, you would be disappointed if you wanted an anagami, and in return you'd be demoted to being a stream winner. Now that's happening. I think apparently that organization was closed down after that news got out. But it's amazing just how much people want to be enlightened. They'd love to have a certificate afterwards. And that is what we call like spiritual materialism. Just thinking, you know, after this retreat you may ask your friends, "How did you do on this retreat?" And you say, "Oh, I got some delightful breath." And your friend said, "Delightful breath? That's nothing. I got that the first day. I got nimittas." And the other friend said, "Nimittas? That's nothing. I got first jhana. First jhana? Oh, I got that so early. I got third jhana." Unfortunately, some people are like that. They're proud. They compare their attainments to see who is the better nun or the better monk, by just telling people what they've achieved. Now, as monks, as nuns, we should know that we never use anything as a source of pride. That we're supposed to be lessening our sense of self, not building it up. So if any of you, you know, that you look at a monk like me, and you, "Oh, if only I could have all these people follow me. If only I could have special meals in the morning, toast and oatmeal. If only I could have that." Then don't be jealous. It's a pain in the backside to be a teacher. Please never try and be famous or well known. I don't have much rest at all. As soon as I go back from here, I go back to Singapore and give more talks. One night in Singapore and then over to Perth to give more talks. And then to Thailand to teach another retreat. And then, where's the next place? To Hong Kong. You're just always on the move. Never resting. Never. So, please don't be like me. Don't aspire to be the great teacher. A lot of times I tell people in Australia, I really try to tell terrible jokes during my talks. The intention behind that was to make people so upset that they never invite me back again, because monks aren't supposed to tell jokes. And so they'll never invite me back so I can have a nice peaceful time. I don't need to go to give any talks anymore. That was my intention, but it backfired because now people like those jokes, even monks. So they invite me to come back again. Crazy. But, so unfortunately though, there is a whole tradition now of people wanting to be teachers. And it means those who really aren't qualified to teach usually do become the teachers. And those who really are qualified, you know, they don't really want to teach, and there's good reasons for that. But honestly, if any of you do get anything in your practice, please come out and share it with others. There's so many people who need good teachers, and a monk like me can't come every year. This is impossible. So this is why I've come here, to make more teachers. So each one of you can actually realize the Dhamma and then use your experience to be able to present the Dhamma and share it with others. Just like my breakfast in the morning or my lunch. Even if it wasn't that much, I still wouldn't just eat it all by myself. It's much nicer to share. You get much more pleasure sharing whatever you have with other people than keeping it to yourself. And that's just with a breakfast or with a lunch. How much more so with the Dhamma? If you have some good Dhamma, please share it. And I want monks and nuns to share that Dhamma. Otherwise, lay people fill that void. And now there's so many lay people. You can actually, if you want to go on the internet, sort of enlightenment or arahats, you find this whole list of lay people claiming to be enlightened. And my goodness, you listen to a little bit of what they say, and that is just so crazy stuff. There's such a hunger, you know, for authority, that many people, they just, they lie, say they're enlightened. Like, there was one teacher many years ago, he was a Hindu teacher, is that Bhagavan Rajneesh, who became notorious. And he was one of the people who said, and it was such a popular teaching in the West, and you can understand why, he said, I'm so detached, I'm not even attached to detachment. That's very clever, but it means it's an excuse, he can do whatever he wants. And many people, they just were so stupid, they believed that. So as many people go out there pretending to be enlightened, the only reason is because that gives them authority. If you went to a hospital and you had to have surgery, wouldn't you look at that doctor's certificates first of all to make sure that, you know, he had graduated from the university and the medical school and he was admitted to the College of Surgeons in Sri Lanka? You'd want to make sure that that surgeon was qualified. And so, quite obviously, the people learning meditation, they would like to see the qualifications of the teacher, first of all. And for some lay people, they keep on saying, oh, you know, I've got jhanas, I've got enlightenment, and they certainly have not. And so it's very difficult, because that is just almost their permission to teach. That's their sense of self. And it's so hard if, you know, somebody comes along and said, unfortunately, that's not a jhana. Unfortunately, that is not Magapala. And they get very resistant because that attacks one of the most essential parts of who they think they are, the sense of self, which is, you know, it's a great difficulty. Too many people going out there saying they're enlightened when they're not. So, how do we know what enlightenment is? And so this is one of the talks, first of all. But I'm going to start off with what enlightenment is not. Because I have my own experience. Sometimes to lay people, I say, this is when I became enlightened. And they all look, he's making a claim. Ajahn Brahm, he really is enlightened. He just said it, when I became enlightened. But more accurately, it was when I thought I was enlightened. It lasted all about sort of maybe about 8 or 9 hours. And it's a wonderful, it would be wonderful if it lasted a bit longer. It's a wonderful feeling to think you're enlightened. So this particular story of when I really thought I'd become an arahat was my 4th year as a bhikkhu in this very remote monastery in the northeast of Thailand. There was nothing much going on there. So I had all day, night to meditate. And I was really getting into my meditation. It was the was season, and my meditation was getting deeper and better, and more joy, more mindfulness. And it was one evening, just late at night, maybe 10 or 11 o'clock. Interestingly, on the walking path, doing Jhankama. Wow, your mind really got still. And just really open, all hindrances, you couldn't find one anywhere. And with all that mind free of hindrances, all these great insights started coming in. Not looking for them. Not trying to contemplate. They all just came by themselves. Now, things I'd never understood before. Insights which I never even looked for before. They came to me. And they got bigger and bigger, and it was really interesting, getting more and more joy, more and more happiness, until the big one came. Wow. That really knocked my mind to smithereens. And afterwards, I realized that was the big one. Non-self. Enlightenment. I was the newest arahat in Thailand. And so, once you had that experience, so much bliss, so much joy. Just you were walking on that meditation path like floating in air, with a mind in the highest heaven, so blissed out. And you got to 12, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning, no tiredness at all. Your mind was perfectly clear. I did go back to my room to lay down for maybe half an hour. And there's no sleep at all, just rest the body. 2:30, up in the meditation hall, sitting cross-legged, perfectly still. Not in the jhanas, because they rang the bell at 3 o'clock. Oh, what joy. Nothing could irritate you. And most mornings, this was in really hot weather. Now, even right now, I see some of you in blankets, and I think, my goodness, how can you wear a blanket in this hot weather? So I really like the cold. Last February, I went to Korea, up in the mountains in Wonju province or somewhere around there. The mountains. It was minus 15 degrees centigrade. Oh, that was so nice. I enjoyed it. It was just really, you know, the right temperature, sort of. Anyway, I often tell people, you know, if you like cold weather and you go to cold climates, you live longer. It's been well proven by science. Just like the same reason why you put things like butter in the fridge, because if you put it in the refrigerator, it lasts much longer before it decays. So the same reason goes in cold climates. You don't sort of decay that fast. It's proven, that's why you put things in the refrigerator. But there I was, just all nicely enlightened. No sloth and torpor. The body couldn't get sort of start nodding. It was perfectly clear. And we used to do this chanting in Thailand. It wasn't Pirit chanting. We do it in Pali first and then in Thai. And it was just so bad, the chanting. To this day, our 9 years of listening to that morning chant, which went on for about an hour, I've been traumatized by it. Every time I think of it, my body, no, it's not that bad, but it was like traumatic. Very lot of suffering. But this morning, oh, that chanting, I was really loud. You know, like that Pavarotti, really booming voice. Because, you know, just newly enlightened. And after the chanting, you went on arms round. And every person who gave this piece of rice into my bowl, I just blew them away with my metta. You are so fortunate, villager. Today you've given a lump of rice to an arahat. You don't know how lucky you are. Zap. And I really believed it. And then when I came back to the Dharamsala, this was in the northeast of Thailand. And in those days, the food has changed now. In those days, many of those Western monks had traveled throughout the world. And we all agreed, without any argument, that the worst food in the world was in northeast Thailand. Honestly. What did we sort of have? We have like buffalo placenta soup, frog soup, ants' eggs, snails, anything which crawled, we ate. And the standard meal every day we had in this monastery was rotten fish curry. Now, to understand what rotten fish was, the villagers would catch the fish during the rainy season, the wasps. And after that, it all dried up. There's no rivers, no fish around, so they had to preserve those fish. And just by the way, that when I first went to Thailand, and all these villagers who were close supporters of the monastery were catching fish, I said, you're breaking your precepts. That's the first precept, you're catching fish. You know what the villagers said? Said, no, this is Thai wisdom. Don't follow it. They said, no, we're keeping our precepts even though we catch fish. Because all we do is we pull the fish out of the water and it dies by itself. We don't kill it. Which is the sort of excuses people make, to try and stop, realizing they're breaking precepts. But anyway, once they caught the fish, they put them in jars, put a piece of plastic over the top, and just keep it. No salt, no preservatives. And I remember, just to show you what it was like, I remember doing some cleaning up around the kitchen in the monastery where I was staying at the time, and finding one of those jars. And the plastic on the top had been broken. And the fish packed inside, no salt, no preservative, was crawling with maggots all over it. And so I took it up and went to throw it away. And at that point, the head man of the village, who happened to be visiting, said, what are you doing? I said, look, it's gone off. It's just all these maggots. He said, no, give it to me. That's extra protein. And that's what I had to eat the next day. It was rotten, stank, tasted awful, but that's all we had. Day after day after day, rotten fish curry. And sticky rice, that was all. Nothing else. So this particular day, when I came back, freshly enlightened, I saw there were two pots of curry. Only used to be one. And I saw that the other pot of curry had been brought in from the town, from the city. And it was actually delicious. It was actually something you could eat. It was town food, not village food. And straight away I thought, ah, that must have been brought by the Devas to celebrate my enlightenment. That's what I thought. Something I could eat today. So there was the two pots of curry, and we all had our sticky rice. And I was the number two monk in that monastery, even only four reigns. My fourth was there still. You know, there's not many monks in these monasteries, so I was the second. And the abbot, he was a local boy born in that village, one of Ajahn Chah's disciples. And so he had the first choice of those curries. And even though he grew up on rotten fish curry, still, he had this huge ladle. And he put so much of the delicious curry into his bowl. It was like a pork curry. So much he put in. No one, not even 10 monks, could eat that much. But it didn't matter because there was plenty left for myself and the other monks. But what he did next, was incredible. Having taken so much for himself, first of all, just for the pork curry, he lifted up the pot of pork curry and he poured it in to the pot of rotten fish curry, stirred it up, saying, it's all the same, it's all the same. And I thought, if it's all the same, why did you take yours out first before mixing it up? You hypocrite, you greedy pig, look how much you've taken, and now you've spoiled and destroyed my celebratory lunch. I'm an arahat, don't worry about food. And they don't get angry. And that was one of the most moments of so much suffering in my monastic life. If you want to know what real suffering is, to believe you're enlightened and find out you're not, that is suffering. But that was really a good lesson for me, because I realized that, you know, afterwards you don't mind what you eat, just pour it in, just I'm not in line, I'm already depressed, it doesn't matter anymore. But it was just so easy to believe you're enlightened. Just all of the things came in, great insights, bliss, no tiredness, hindrances, totally, you can't see them for anywhere at all, until something happens, the anger, desire, fear, one of those things comes up. So this happens sometimes, and sometimes describe these experiences, which, you know, you will have sooner or later, if you haven't had them already. Sometimes you get really nice deep meditation, and get incredible insights. And with those insights, there's always a lot of bliss, and wow, this is amazing, lots of joy. Hindrances are gone for a long time, but you've got to wait. You've got to wait to see if those hindrances or those kalachas come back again. Sometimes I describe it like a bomb going off. And after a bomb going off, there's smoke and dust all over the place, you can't see anything. And then once the dust settles, then you find out what buildings, what defilements are left standing. Yes, that insight, that experience weakened the hindrances, but some of them are still there. So you've got to be really, really, really careful there. So it's also important to actually to know what that enlightenment actually is. And of course, the basic first stage of enlightenment, the stream winning, you know, the Sakaya Ditti, you know, that there's no self anywhere to be found, any place, wherever. You know, in particular, you know, the five khandhas, none of that is a me, mine, or a self. And there's nothing beyond those five khandhas. Because that's why sometimes, you know, the craving, the attachment to a sense of self, a me, mine, is so strong that sometimes we try and find any place, any little loophole, any crack, so we can exist. It's like we always crave for like a retirement home after we become enlightened. A place we can just relax and rest and be happy ever after. And unfortunately, that in Sri Lanka, you know, people actually teach the Dharma from the suttas, and it's pretty good stuff. Unfortunately, in Thailand, and I was in Thailand, they don't really look at the suttas that much. And this is honestly, because I was there, though we did have copies of the suttas and of Vinaya, and they were kept in a cabinet, locked, and they wouldn't let us have the key. We would bow to them in the morning, but we would never read them. There's something terribly wrong with that. So it's wonderful, actually, to have a look at those suttas. It gives you at least, you know, keeps you from going too far off the track. And unfortunately, even some of my friends I grew up with still have this idea that there is somewhere, someplace, a me, a mine, where you can exist after Parinirvana. And they keep saying, well, what's the point of actually becoming enlightened? It's just like spiritual suicide. You're killing yourself. It's annihilation. But of course the answer is, it's not annihilation, there's nothing there to begin with. So how can there be anything which is destroyed? Just causes and effects which come to an ending. And that's really so clear. If anybody wants to actually see so clearly that this is not annihilation, it's the Samyutta Nikaya, the 22nd Samyutta Nikaya, I think that's a Khanda Samyutta. And there you have the Buddha saying, actually no, it's Sariputta I believe saying, that you cannot see or you cannot say there is a Buddha, even right now, he said, when he's still alive. There's just five khandhas, there's nothing more than that, nothing outside of those five khandhas where you can actually see a Buddha. You can't actually find a Buddha right now. So there's nothing destroyed. It's just what was rising and passing away, causes and conditions have just ceased, that's all. But it's incredible, it's so clear in the suttas, but people will not see that. And this is what happens. That there comes a time when you are so free of those hindrances that you can see what you blocked out for lifetimes. to be able to, for that scientist to see the flower pot rise, his views would actually block that. You just can't even see it, which is one of the problems. You can never know that you're not enlightened, except with some of the signs like anger or greed or lust, those sorts of things, which are very easy to know. But the delusion means you can't see it. And it's so easy, because of the nature of delusion, to see what you want to see and think and perceive that you have become a stream winner, a once-returner, non-returner, or arahat. It's such a danger. Which is one of the reasons why, if ever you do achieve any of those states and you think you are a stream winner, a once-returner, non-returner, or arahat, please keep it quiet. Don't go around telling people. Because if you go around telling people, sometimes you would imagine they may have some joy in your attainment. Well, unfortunately, the most people are not enlightened, and so they'll have jealousy and even ill will. They'll say, who are you to think you're enlightened? Metta vihari, and you think you're a stream winner? Ha 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 ha. No way. And unfortunately, that's how people think. It's jealousy. So in order to avoid people making bad karma, just please keep it quiet. And if you can't keep it quiet, you need to tell somebody that shows it's not stream winning. The need to tell. Why? It's just a way of boasting. It's just a way of saying just how wonderful you are. It is just saying that yourself has achieved something and you need someone to know it. You need to celebrate it. So be very careful to always keep these things very, very quiet. And also, you know, sometimes it takes many years after that explosion has gone off for defilements to arise. Many people think they were attained, and then many years later, sometimes they realize it was not the case. There's an old Chinese story, which I heard a long time ago, which I wrote in my meditation booklet, so some of you heard it before, but it's a great story. It was a story of this Mahayana monk in China, a long time ago, who told the humdro of his temple, and he said, I really want to get enlightened in this life. I want to go for Nirvana. And he said, not far from the temple, there is an island in the lake. And it's no one lives there. So can I please have permission, humdro, to build a simple hut there, and maybe a little garden, just to get some vegetables for myself. The Mahayana tradition, you can do that. And all I ask is, you know, if you would send an attendant over once a week, in case there's any requisites I need, just once a week, and I'll write out a list of what I need, and then he can bring it the next week when he comes. So I can live in solitude, with no duties, just to be a hermit on this island. Can I do that? This sounds idyllic, doesn't it? So, the abbot said, well, it's a noble request. Yes, I'll arrange that. So this young monk built a hut on this island, and once a week the attendant would come, and if anything he really needed, you know, maybe some rice, or needed some matches or something, just ordinary requisites, the attendant would give it to him. And after 3 years, in solitude, meditating so diligently, this young monk, he came to the conclusion he had no more defilements, that he was an arahat. So he decided he'd had to inform his humdro of his amazing achievement. And how he decided to do that, you know, in Chinese tradition, the next time the attendant came, he asked the attendant to please bring some parchment, some ink, and one of these calligraphy pens, like little brushes. He wanted to write a poem in 4 lines to express his enlightenment. So the next week, the attendant brought over the parchment, the ink, and the brush. And then for the next 3 or 4 days, this monk, he meditated so deeply, And when he felt his mind was pure and poised and energized, he wrote his poem in this amazing calligraphy. These days, some of that calligraphy, whether it's in Korea or Japan or China, is regarded as works of art and is exhibited in museums. So the brushwork was just so perfect, as you would expect when you come out of deep meditation. And the words in this four-line poem translated as, "The diligent monk, alone for 3 years, is no longer moved by the four worldly winds." And even in Theravada, we can understand that means a synonym for enlightenment. You're like a post, whichever way the wind blows, praise and blame, any of the loka dhammas, you're unmoved by them. Solid like a rock. No more defilements. So having finished his poem, once it dried, he rolled it up, tied it with a ribbon, and waited for the attendant to come so he could send it to his hamdra. And wondered what the hamdra's response would be. The hamdra's response came next week, when the attendant handed over the same scroll, and he opened it and saw on the first line, "The diligent monk." The hamdra had scrawled on it, like graffiti, the four letters. I don't know if this translates into Sri Lankan, but I'm sure you can arrange it. F-A-R-T. Fart. And on the second line, "Alone for 3 years," there was another four letters, F-A-R-T, but in capital letters. And in the third line, "Is no longer moved." This time, F-A-R-T with an exclamation mark after it. By the four worldly winds, and there's a big, really ugly F-A-R-T. Three underlinings, three exclamation marks after it. And that monk said, "This was historic calligraphy. This should be in the museum. This has been ruined. This monk has got no sensitivity at all. I'm not standing for this." And he immediately jumped up, grabbed the scroll, ran to the shore and just caught the attendant. He said, "Come back. Take me to that abbot." So got the attendant to row him to the shore, go to the temple, went into the hamdra's office, slammed the scroll down and said, "What have you done to my beautiful poem in great calligraphy?" And at that, the hamdra stood up. And he opened the scroll and read it one more time. "The diligent monk, alone for 3 years, is no longer moved by the four worldly winds." And then he looked at that monk and said, "But, monk, four little farts have blown you clean across the lake." Even four little winds have blown you away. And that monk understood, went back to the island, and had to spend another 6 or 7 years. And next time he never wrote any poems. Now that was typical of how monks, even Mahayana tradition, deal with people who think they're enlightened. Anything to try and upset them. Anything to try and get some kilesas up. To stimulate them, to find out if they're really there or not. Because it's so easy to think you are enlightened. So, no self, first of all. And again, the five khandhas. Rupa khandha, you know, it's pretty simple. You would think, you know, to actually understand this body's got nothing to do with you. You've seen so many people dying, you know you're going to die. Do you? How many people, if somebody came up behind you right now with a knife about to slice your head off, would you be scared? We'd say, "Okay, you can do it if you want. It's not your body. It doesn't matter." How many of you, if you went to see your doctor, and the doctor says, "The cancer is incurable. You're going to die." That's one of my favourite monks, you know, K.C. Dhammananda. I saw his doctor, because I go to Malaysia very often, and his doctor said he's the only person, the only one he's ever seen, who, when he was told he's only got a few months to live, his cancer is terminal, burst out laughing. He actually laughed. He thought it was so funny. So at least you can say that, you know, he wasn't attached to his rupa kanda. Because, you know, when it was really challenged, about to be taken away, he let it take away. How many of you get scared when your body starts to disappear and your breath stops in meditation? Ah! It's amazing. That shows you there's still some attachment to your rupa kanda. You haven't really let it go. You still think it's yours. And whether you're attached to, there's a self behind this somewhere. There's a me and mine. That's how you know there's still a self there. Not because of theory. Yeah, we can always believe in the Buddha's teaching. Yeah, I know there's no self there. But do you actually really feel that? Is that part of you? When yourself or your body is being challenged, about to be taken away, can you let it go? Nothing to do with me. I'm only a visitor. So if you can do that, rupa kanda, you can tick that one off. You're not afraid of death. It doesn't really matter. Your body vanishes. Your breath stops. Okay. It's just nature, that's all. Nothing to do with me. And the Vedana. How many of you just want to be pleasant, warm all the time? How many of you can take off your blankets and just be cold? It's just Vedana, that's all. But sometimes that we assume we know that Vedana is an ounce, which is one of the reasons we're always looking for pleasure and always trying to avoid pain. Anything which is going to harm the body, fair enough. But anything which is just pleasure or pain, you tend to just, it's not me, not mine. What's the bother? And there's one thing which I noticed, that if it is painful, really painful, you know it's not going to last. It can't. If it's really, really painful, after a while you get used to it. Just like that rotten fish curry. It was really disgusting, but after a while you got used to it. And sometimes it was even pleasant. One day there was a little bit less disgusting than usual, and that was pleasant. That's all what pleasure and pain is. As somebody said, that happiness, pleasure, beauty is only a space between two ugly moments. And the more ugly, unpleasant it was before, the more happy it is afterwards. It's the pain, the suffering before, conditions the amount of happiness which comes afterwards, once that dukkha is taken away. So I know that I've very rarely been sick, but I remember when I did have a bad sickness, I never felt more healthy than after a sickness. Because in normal health, I just take it for granted, you don't notice it. But once you've just been through a sickness and very weak, tired, fever, whatever it was, when that finishes, then you can really appreciate good health. Then it's happy. So because of that, the Vedana, Sukha and Dukkha, they just run around each other. You cannot have one without the other. So you can't have all Dukkha, 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 Dukkha. You have to have some Sukha every now and again. So, and you can't have Sukha, 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 Sukha. It has to be some Dukkha. Otherwise the Sukha would not be noticed anymore. Oh, that's Vedana. It's not me. And, you know, in my early years, I spent such a long time trying to control it, trying to get rid of dukkha and only get more sukha. And haven't you realized by now it doesn't work? You can't control it. It belongs to nature, not to you. Even your health of the body, yeah, you can't control it. You try and be healthy and you end up getting sick. So just let it be. Health, sickness is just part of the body, nothing to do with you. And then you got sanya perceptions. That's not you. Sometimes we think that I am seeing this. I am hearing this talk. I am understanding what's going on. Much of your perceptions is conditioned, is brainwashed by your culture. Just I mentioned about the flower pot. That perception of a scientist, they cannot see that. Now, I was talking with Kusala this morning that I go to many, many conferences with scientists, because I was a scientist myself. And just how dogmatic and blind scientists can be. Because they have one particular view, and all their perceptions have to be in line with that view. And they cannot see their mistakes. They just can't. Just like that scientist couldn't see that flower pot. Just like people who aren't enlightened can't see where they're holding on to a sense of self. So anyway, and the big ones. Sankhara. And I don't know why people keep calling Sankhara conditioned things. Let's get back to the real heart of Sankhara. The will. That's much more challenging to people. Yeah, conditioned things aren't me, not mine. But volitional formations. Volition. Will. And that's such a core part of Sankhara. Now, have you seen yet that you are out of control? That your will does not come from a self? That your will has nothing to do with me? That your will is not something to be strengthened and taught how to be wise? That's why that simile of the driverless bus is very evocative. There's no one in there. There is no will. The Buddha said that. But still, you act as if you're in charge. Which means when you get frustrated, you get angry. Why do you do that for? Ajahn Brahm, why did you say that? I never said it. But didn't you will it? No, no, it wasn't will. It was just causes and conditions. I often tell people, and this is not just a joke, but this is actually quite true. Why do I tell jokes? I'm a bhikkhu. Are monks allowed to tell jokes? Whether I'm allowed to or not, I'm out of control. My father told jokes. He conditioned me. And my will, in the joke setting, comes from my father. That's all it is. I'm just like each one of you are conditioned, your will. Why you say things, why you do things. Where does that come from? Is it really you? Or is it conditions and causes? Who makes the choices in your life? Who decides to meditate? Who decides to watch the breath? Or rather, what decides to watch the breath? It's a very tough thing to see that your will is nothing to do with you. Part of nature, not mine. Not me, nothing to do with me. And for that, and that's a great thing to see, the will stop and it's nothing to do with you. That's one of the big ones. To actually to see through non-self. Understand the nature of volition. And of course the consciousness as well. You're not just sitting here listening to all of this. Just that mind always coming and going. Subject to cessation. Nothing to do with you. It is not you who's listening to this talk. It's just five candles doing their thing. Easy to say. Easy to think, but so hard to actually to see, because it's going against lifetimes of conditioning, lifetimes of identification with these things as a person, as a me, as the emperor sitting on the throne of your body and mind, the will, giving orders, saying how you're going to run your life, arguing on what's right, what's wrong. That's all will. So that's why I gave similes. Your body and mind is like a prisoner in this prison with five huge walls. And those huge walls are seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. Most people can't get beyond those five senses. And you have a prison guard called Will, who never lets you be still, even for a moment. Always order you, get up, go down, go here, go there. And you've got so used to that prison guard that you think it's your friend. Never allowing you to be still. The will always making you move. And so some people, they try and make the best out of prison. They go and marry another prisoner. They go and have nice little prison children. they go to work in prison, and if they do well at work, they build this huge cell within prison, and they're so proud that their cell is bigger than other people's cells. And they have a nice little car to go from one cell to another, sometimes a nice Mercedes or a Volvo. And they feel just how wonderful they are, and some people actually stand for election in the prison government and think that they're in full power because, you know, now they're the president or the prime minister of the prison. And some people, you know, even are very, very kind and generous, and they try and look after all the poor people in prison and make their cells a little bit more comfortable. And it's, many people learn how to be doctors in prison, trying to treat all the other prisoners. But no one realizes they're in prison. So no one ever tries to escape, to go to some sense of freedom, out of prison. They don't even know that outside prison exists. And then this prisoner, or once a prisoner, called Siddhartha Gautama, escapes, goes through this tunnel with eight passages, the Eightfold Path, finds out, yeah, this life outside of jail, Nibbana. Actually, jhanas, first of all, and then Nibbana. Because actually jhana when the five senses, and he comes back to teach other people, comes back to jail, to teach everybody else. Here you can fix up yourself, you can be rich and famous inside jail, but you're still in prison. And the will has never allowed you to be peaceful for one moment. Even at night time, as the Buddha said, during the day you're like an anthill, a flame, at night time you smoke. Never really cool and peaceful. So, then the Buddha tells where the tunnel is, just over there, Eightfold Path. Off you go. Because the Eightfold Path needs to be so still. Stillness is important because that's the only thing which sends the prison guard, the will, to sleep. The will is not active anymore. You slow down and calmed the will. Sabba Sankara Samatha. That's what the Buddha said. Most people find it very difficult to understand. The calming of all will. Don't say formations, misses the point of will. And then when you've calmed the will down, when the prison guards are asleep, then you can escape. Prison guards are asleep, not on the job. Then you can walk out of jail. So that is the nature of the will. And little similes like that make it much easier to understand. It's scary going out of jail. Never been there before. And many people are just too happy to be in jail. That is like one of my similes, one of my favorite similes. I'm going to continue this talk maybe at 3 o'clock, but then I'm going to finish with this simile because I love this simile because it's offensive, but so accurate. Once upon a time, I think it's from the sutra somewhere, there were these two monks, and these two monks were best friends. And even though you're best friend, you don't know what, you know, your friendly monk is doing when he's in his hut at night, or what he's doing when he's meditating. You could be fantasizing or doing all sorts of stupid stuff in his mind. But anyway, when they died, one of the monks was reborn in the heaven realm. Well, really pissed because he was reasonably good monk. The other monk, he must have done something very, very bad because he was reborn as a worm in a pile of cow dung. And after a few short time up in heaven, the heavenly being started to think, where is my friend? We were so close together in our previous life. And he's not in this heaven realm. So, according to this story, these devas, they used their psychic powers. He looked around all the heavenly realm for his best friend. Couldn't find him anywhere there. And then the thought arose in him, maybe my best friend has been reborn in the human realm. Because in the human realm, it's a very fortunate existence because there you can meet the Dharma. There you can make progress. He may have been more fortunate than me. I've just been reborn in the heaven realm. So he looked around the human realm, couldn't find his friend anywhere there. He said, oh no, he hasn't been reborn as an animal. So he looked amongst all the horses and the elephants and the major animals, couldn't find his friend there anyway. Looked in the medium animals, the dogs and the cats and the snakes, couldn't find him there. Then looked amongst the creepy crawlies, And there, to his great horror, he found that his best friend had been reborn as a worm in a pile of shit. And at that he thought, oh my goodness, what bad karma has he done? But never mind, I'm his best friend. I will go and help him. So even though he was a heavenly being, you know, he appeared in front of this stinking, steaming, fresh pile of cow dung. And he called out to his friend, hey friend, worm. And this little head poked out, this little worm, said, do you remember me? Worm said, no. And said, we were monks together in a previous life. We were best friends. Oh, really? Said the worm. And I've been reborn in the heaven realm. It's so beautiful and refined and peaceful there. Because of some bad karma, you've been reborn as a worm in a pile of shit. But doesn't matter, I can help you. Come with me up to heaven. And the worm said, just one moment, one moment. In heaven, is there any shit? And the heavenly being said, of course not. In the heavenly realms, you don't have feces. Heavenly beings don't go to the toilet. I don't think they have toilets. They're refined. So, the worm said, well, if there's no shit, I'm not going. Because I like my dung. It's my food. It's delicious. I eat it every day. And it's warm and fragrant. It's my home. And the heavenly being said, this is filthy stuff. It's much nicer food up in heaven. Much more peaceful, much more delicious, much more fragrant. But the worm said, no dung, no go. So what can you do with a worm like that? So the heavenly being said, if I can only show it what heaven is like, give it personal experience, ehi pasiko, come and see. Pachatangwe ditabo winyuhi, to experience it for himself. If he can only see heaven, he will surely understand how superior heaven is to a pile of shit. So the heavenly being put his hand in the shit and grabbed hold of the worm and tried to pull it out. Now imagine a heavenly being doing that. Do you think like Queen Elizabeth would even do that, put her hand in a pile of shit to save somebody? And she's only like a high human being, high class. But friendship is so important. We look after our friends. This heavenly being was even willing to put his very refined hands in the pile of dung to rescue his friend. But his friend, the worm, never wanted to go. Leave me alone. I don't want to go. Leave me alone. And he wriggled. Now, because that worm was covered with shit is very slippery and slimy. So it wasn't that hard for him to wriggle and escape, and he went right down into the furthest part of the pile of dung to escape. But that never stopped. That never stopped the heavenly being. The heavenly being held his nose with one hand and put his other hand in there, searching and searching for the worm. When he found it, tried to pull it out. But every day he got it out, the worm went back again. For 9 days, that heavenly being tried to pull the worm out of the pile of dung. But the worm never wanted to go. Every time escaped and wriggled back into the pile of dung. That's what we call attachment. Even to filthy, dirty, disgusting things. For a worm, their pile of dung is the most beautiful thing in the whole world. We don't want to go. I have now been teaching this retreat for 9 days. For 9 days, I've been trying to pull you out, your pile of shit. I get you out so far, and limiters, then you go back in again. You don't want to go. That is called attachment. And it's so hard to pull people out. And you get so far, and then you go back again. All of you lay people, once you finish this retreat, are you going to renounce, become monks or nuns? Or are you going to go back to your pile of dung? But it's nice, it's warm, and it's cozy. Yeah, it might seem that way to a worm. But that's how difficult it is to become enlightened. Because our perception is, what's the problem? We're happy. You think you are. Inside jail, we don't know anything else. The will is your prison guard. Consciousness is suffering. It's dukkha. To see, to hear, to smell, to taste, to touch, to know is essentially suffering. We don't think that way. We only think to see rotten things is suffering. Have physical pain is suffering. Have physical pleasure, that's not suffering. Oh, yes, it is. You're in jail. Even the most pleasurable experiences in jail is suffering compared to what's outside. Even the most beautiful mind states is suffering compared to when the mind finishes and ceases. Nibbanam paramam sukham. If you understand that, then you've seen suffering everywhere. All the five khandhas, even in the most wonderful form, is still suffering. Dukkha, through and through. The will, nothing to do with you. The will is suffering. Do not encourage your will. Do not build it up and strengthen it. That's one of the reasons I always say striving is counterproductive. It just builds up a stronger sense of self. If you've been successful in life, you end up getting big egos, like a Donald Trump. Very successful, huge ego, totally deluded. It's much better if you fail in life. It's much better because that makes you more, less of a control freak. Much more understanding that you aren't in control. Your ego gets less. So don't be successful. Fail. Failure is beautiful. Chips away your sense of self. Until eventually you can see that there is no self. So why are you striving? Or rather, who is striving? Who is doing all this hard work? And is it really getting you anywhere? Or are you just getting more and more frustrated? Sooner or later, you may succeed, but you eventually must fail. That's what happens with an ego, a sense of self. Think as it can get enlightened. You cannot get in line with the sense of self. The path is, but no traveller is seen on it. Nibbana is, you can't enter it. You have to disappear. And in particular, your will has to go. Let go. Renounce. Be kind. Kind is not controlling, just letting things be with kindness. It's not exterminating the pests. It's learning how to live with them. Pest exterminators, is that a good right livelihood for a Buddhist in Sri Lanka? Pest exterminators, what about Kalasia exterminators? Is that a good is that a good livelihood for monks? Same thing really, just trying to destroy stuff which you don't agree with. So, just learn how to see things in a different way. Five khandhas, so when you become a stream winner, whoa, then life is easy. There's no self in there. You see that? You haven't totally realized it. Well, I'll tell you the difference between a stream winner and an arahat this afternoon, 3 p.m, because I'm gone over time. So anyway, there's a few stories about enlightenment. If you are enlightened, just keep quiet. Don't brag about it. Otherwise, why would you brag about it? Just a sense of self. And just it's just you disappearing. And just to test if there's any sort of defilements left, that's how you know roughly where you are. It doesn't really matter anyway, because you're nowhere. And what else did I say? Oh, actually, if someone does ask you, I'll finish off with this. I know there was one Sri Lankan monk I really liked. If I'd have met him as a layperson, I would have probably become a Sri Lankan monk, joined the Sri Lankan tradition. That was a monk called Ananda Mangala, a long time ago. He was an associate with all these great monks, Venerable Dasi, Gunaratana, Narada, Kesi Dhammananda, because they all lived in, or they were visiting Malaysia. One of the stories, I think it was Venerable Dasi said this, or was it Venerable Gunaratana? He said they were in this temple in Kuala Lumpur, the Brickfields Temple, the Sri Lankan temple in Kuala Lumpur, and they're having some tea, and one of these evangelical Christians came in, actually two of them, trying to convert these monks. Now, that's just how arrogant and cheeky these evangelicals are. And all of them didn't know what to do, except Ananda Mangala. He just, you know, he was just totally rebellious, totally, you know, his own non-person. He just looked at these evangelical Christians and said to them, "Get out of here, you bloody fools." And it's not the sort of speech a monk should say, but it was highly effective. And they went straight away. No argument at all. "Get out of here, you bloody fools," he said. And all the other monks were so happy he said that. Saved him a lot of argument. But he was also the one, he would come to Perth a few times. And when people asked him, "Are you enlightened?" he would answer, "No, I'm highly eliminated." And I love that turn of phrase. Not illuminated, not enlightened, but eliminated. What a wonderful expression it is of the path to enlightenment. The more enlightened you are, the more eliminated you are. So if anybody asks you, "How's your practice going?" you said, "I'm getting more and more eliminated." And that's a wonderful description of the path. Very good. Okay, enough.